Welcome to the Been There, Done That podcast with Angela Dunn Cartledge. Hey there, it's Angela from Been There, Done That. If you're navigating the wild, unpredictable world of grief, I want to invite you to something special. It's called Messy Mornings, and it's our free weekly newsletter filled with real talk, gentle reminders, and support that actually meets you where you are. Each week, I'll send you stories, reflections, healing prompts straight to your inbox. No fluff, no pressure, just the space to release, feel, and heal. You don't have to do this alone. Head over to donethatpodcast.com and sign up for Messy Mornings. It's totally free, and it's made with you in mind. I've been there, and let's walk through this together.
Hi, everybody. This is the Been There, Done That podcast.
I'm your host, Angela Dunn Cartledge, and I'm here with my good friend, my new good friend, Daryl Dittmer. I can't wait to have this conversation. Daryl, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Angela. I really appreciate you having me.
Tell us a little bit about who you are, what you bring to us, and what you want to bring to the show today.
Sure. It's been an interesting life, which it's been wonderful and challenging and, you know, just a whole bunch of things, to throw in that mix. But I'm an author, and most currently my intent in this life is to give back, to take some of the things that were given to me and taught me by mentors and just by, you know, wonderful people who have entered my life, and I'm trying to give that back in the context of my books, but also in the context of how I practice my life so that I can be in a position to give back, so that I can allow myself to give back. And that's where I'm at now. I've done a lot of things in this life, from an occupational perspective, from a sports perspective, all those sorts of things. But my intent now is to do the best I can to give back to the world and to as many people as I can.
I love that. I have a similar goal and passion. So I'm glad that we are having this conversation today. Talk to us about your overcoming, your resilience story. And it can start as early as you want it to and go down whatever path and rabbit hole you'd like to take us on. But talk to us about what you see and what your perspective is on resilience.
Yes, resilience. It's it's one of those things that the longer we go in life, I think the more we need to adopt and grow our resilience. I look at resilience as a muscle. It's something we need to utilize and to strengthen in our lives. So I started I'm from the Midwest, actually. I was born in Detroit. We talked about the Detroit Lions sitting behind me here. So I was born in Detroit, and in my younger years, we moved out to the country. My dad was a mechanic. He was a Navy veteran, a pretty tough dude. I think for the most part, a very fair guy, but tough and strict. And I think that's how he was raised. My mom was probably about the same in terms of, you know, fairly tough and strict. So we grew up with the rules. We grew up with pretty hard and fast, way that we needed to approach things, way that we needed to live. Religion was something that we were, we went to church every Sunday, all that sort of thing. So that's kind of from whence I came. Just a little bit about the family that I grew up in. I have an older brother and a younger sister. And when I was 13, I had my first drink of alcohol, and that was something where it made me feel good. It made me loosen up. It made me, you know, not so anxious and afraid and full of, you know, anxiety. I think I was a pretty high strung kid. I think now they might call it some sort of a malady. I don't know. But always high energy, you know, always just getting in trouble, that sort of thing. Even before I took a drink. So when I took a drink, it was just pouring gas onto the fire and the fire that was already lit inside me. And so I don't want to make a long story too long, but I progressed in the drinking and the drugs and throughout my teens and throughout high school. And I got into a bunch of different drugs and some definitely some trouble to the point where when I was 18 years old, my parents did basically an intervention and said, you know, you need to straighten up and we need you to go talk to this drug and alcohol counselor. And if you decide to do that, they kind of left it up to me. They said, if you decide to do that, meet us at such and such a place, such and such a time. And that was a very scary moment for me. It was a really scary moment for me. I was 18. I was, you know, I thought I knew a lot. Obviously I didn't. But it was a scary moment for me and something inside of me decided that I wanted to go. I wanted to go find out what was going on, but I also, you know, and the light and the dark sort of sit next to each other, right? So part of me wanted to find out what's going on. And then the other part of me said, well, I'm just going to lie to this person and you know, try to get out of it like I did everything else. And so I went to go talk to this counselor and the first thing he said was, you can't lie to me. You can't BS me. Sorry, but you know, it's just not going to happen. I'm not going to fall for it. We need to have a real conversation. And I was intimidated and I was intimidated because I was young and because he came across very strong. And so I would characterize that conversation as I was as honest as I could be with him at that point in my life. And he's told me I need.
But with what you knew, right, with what you knew of what was happening to you and what you could be aware of, you gave as much as you could. If that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was whatever I was capable of at that time is what I was capable of. And that was, because my life had been characterized literally, and I say this, I've said this a lot over the years, is lying, cheating, and stealing. That's what I did. And so he recommended I go to treatment. And so that was slated for January 3rd of 1985. December 31st of 1984, which was, you know, New Year's Eve, and I was at this party. And this is kind of where I look at it as I couldn't do it anymore. I was at this party and I was around probably a couple hundred people, maybe more. I don't remember who was there. I don't remember who I talked to. I don't remember anything about it. But I do remember this. I remember feeling like I didn't know if I wanted to be on this planet anymore. And that was sort of the culmination of, you know, a fairly short stretch of going downhill pretty fast and characterized by, you know, very difficult relationships with family and friends and many friends, you know, jumped off the bandwagon because some of us were just too hardcore for them. And so my world got small and a lot smaller. So I went into treatment January 3rd of 1985, and I've been sober since, but that's kind of where I look at my second act having started in this life.
That's a powerful moment. Right? I mean, not just for you, but it's powerful to hear it, that you looked around you and went, this isn't working. This isn't where I want to be. And I hear you saying you made a decision. to live instead of to go down the other path, because you very easily could have. And you made a decision to make changes. And from there, what was treatment like? What did that feel like with that decision having already been made, that you were choosing that life path instead of the non-living path?
Yeah, the treatment was difficult. And I think my decision was, and I haven't really thought about this in those terms, Angela, like that, but I think my decision was, I'm going to attempt to try. And that's as far as I could go at that point in my life. Because I didn't know what was on the other side, but I knew what was on this side. And the side that I was on at that time was a dead end. And like you said, kind of a non-life. So I decided to attempt to try, and treatment was all of the things that I didn't have a clue about at that time in my life, which was talking about my feelings, talking about, you know, where my head was, and being honest about some of the things that I did, and owning, owning my responsibility for going down this path, that it wasn't on anyone else. It wasn't on my circumstances. It wasn't on anything but me. And getting out of that was about me taking responsibility. So there were two things that I got out of treatment. And so it was very unfamiliar territory, I didn't grow up talking about my feelings. I grew up hiding my feelings. You know, I grew up, you know, guys don't cry. I grew up, you know, suck it up. You know, if you're not hurt, if there's not a bone sticking out, like that kind of thing. So that's how I grew up. And so this was a departure from that, to say the least. But the two things that I got out of treatment were, I got hope, which was wonderful. And that was something I could carry. And I also got introduced to the 12 steps, which to me was a plan. And I didn't know it then, but I got a plan for living. There's only one of those steps that talks about getting rid of the substances or whatever it is that we're addicted to. And the rest of them are about living. And so it was a plan about living that I was able to adhere myself to. And that's, you know, that's when I started to believe that things could really be different.
And it goes back to what I've
heard and what I try to live in my own life. And that is that most of the time, the thing that we're doing as an action or the behavior that we have has so much underlying garbage that's attached to it, that unless you get to the garbage, you're not going to stop the behavior. So it's mindset, right? It's that concept that we have to dig in to get to the foundation before we can actually rebuild the house in a better way. I have members of my family and have obviously had guests on as well that have gone through the 12 steps. And what I hear the most is exactly what you said, that it gives you a process for every minute, for every second at the beginning, and every minute and every hour and every day and every, you know, it builds on from there, you know, one day at a time kind of concept that is so important when you're, as one of my previous guests call it, crawling out of the pit. That you dug yourself, you had the shovel in your hand, you dug the pit, but you're in it and you don't know how to get out of the pit. So to me, I love the practicality of it. And, you know, like I said, I've known about it for quite some time, but hearing you say that it helped you because it was practical, because it gave you that space to be able to make those choices on your own was important. What did you find to be the most challenging part of that? What was the part that you, or let me flip it around, because I asked about challenge for treatment. What was the best part about it? what did you like the most about the 12 steps? Which step was your favorite?
It's interesting because as I went on, as I moved through the steps and I got a sponsor and I met really cool people, and I tried to stay with people who wanted the life that I wanted and people who were living the life that I wanted. I got a sponsor when I was, very early on, and he contributed greatly to some of the things I write about in my book, actually a lot of the first book. He said to me, and this is probably the most important thing that I heard early on in sobriety, he said, "Daryl, when you stop fighting, the fighting stops." And that was incredibly powerful for me to hear. And I've been nurturing that sort of pondering for a long, long time, many decades. And that's been something that's been wonderful for me. But my favorite step probably is, because the steps are hard, you know, like you mentioned it, taking out the garbage. I mean, that's what it's about. That is absolutely what it's about. It's clearing the wreckage of my past, clearing, and not just my past, because I think we look at our past and we're like, oh, that's outside me somewhere. Well, no, we're clearing the wreckage of what's inside me. And so clearing the wreckage of what's inside me and changing, consciously changing my behaviors, consciously changing how I go about living, making a decision about how I show up in the world every day. Am I good for myself? You said mindset, which I agree 100%. Am I good for myself, but am I good for the world? Can I stop thinking about myself long enough to give a smile to someone or to help someone or to, you know, like those kinds of things? And I think that's crucial. But my favorite step is step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him, and et cetera, praying only for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. That makes me think of the practices that I've had to develop in my life to continue to show up in a way that is great for myself, but also great for the rest of the world. And I think that's important. And I do things like I do a breathing practice. I do a meditation practice. I practice gratitude. I exercise. I do my best to show up for myself, so that I can have that emanate from me to other people.
Yeah, I love the gratitude piece of that, particularly because I think that gratitude and forgiveness are very closely linked for me. And so I see that would be very, very therapeutic, very helpful in a path of trying to, I loved your phrasing of clear the wreckage. That's so cool to think about from somebody who loves to-do lists and getting rid of things. That's a cool visual that you gave me for that particular piece of the process. And it's ongoing, right? It's not just this one, okay, well, I went through treatment, now we're good, I don't have any more wreckage to clean up. You find new things as you dig in deeper to where that leads. But that I really love that concept of being able to build on top of what has happened to build a better life and to be better for not just yourself, but the world. Super cool. So with that in mind, tell us what the books are about. Tell us about what you bring to the world that you learned in this process and what you want our audience to learn from you.
My first book is called When I Stop Fighting. And the subtitle is The Unexpected Joy of Getting My Head Out of My, you know what. So it's about overcoming addiction, overcoming dysfunction, overcoming adversity, taking risks. It's my story of of a lot of losing, a lot of winning. I would say a lot of losing, some winning, which is just part of it because we have to go through those stumbles, you know, to continue to move forward. And those are just stepping stones. It's about vulnerability and moving my life toward authenticity. You know, that's really, and me toward authenticity, being the best me that I can be and showing up as me every day. So one of the greatest, things that has been said about my book is that it's not a, you know, you should, or here's what you have to do book. It's not an advice book. It's a book that's about my story and how many times I've been knocked down and how many times I've had to get up and the lessons that I learned. I look at it more like, you know, just a guide. If you can relate and pull some things from it, you know, which a lot of people said that they have, which makes me happy, then it's all worth it to me. So that's the first book. The second book is called When You Stop Fighting. And the subtitle is The Road You're On Is Your Own Asphalt, which is about what we want from this lifetime. You know, I believe we all have a wish list that probably includes things like happiness or contentment, great relationships, peace of mind, meaning or purpose, and maybe financial security. So how do we get to that wish list? What's stopping us from getting to that wish list? And one of the things that's stopping us is the things that we're, you know, potentially currently, placing a lot of emphasis on, which might be addictions or, you know, some other type of dysfunctional stuff. It can be social media, it can be gambling, it can be drugs, it can be alcohol, it can be food, it can be a number of different things. So how do we clear that wreckage? How do we move forward, you know, inside of us? And ultimately outside of us. So that's, it's more of a, it's a deeper dive, I guess, into life, but it's also, you know, another one of those, not a you should sort of do book. It's not that. It's my stories and overcoming some of the things and saying, you know, if you can relate to this and it helps you, that's what I care about.
I really love the titles because I think, again, I'm always going to lean toward practicality. That's just who I am as a person. But the sheer honesty in the titles bring me laughter because it is so real. What we do to ourselves on purpose or not on purpose, with this idea that we think we know what we're doing and we think we are doing the right thing for ourselves. And then we look at it and go, nobody in their right mind would think this was the right way to do this. Why on earth have I been doing it for this long? And it just takes awareness and intention and all of those things. But to say it so matter-of-factly is refreshing. So it brings a smile to my face simply because I'm like, right, stop. You're the one that's pushing. You're the one digging the hole. Just put down the shovel. Stop. And then you will have less in your way to get through and figure out why you're digging the hole in the first place, right? That if we can just figure out why we hate ourselves so much and why we bring that to the table all the time is just, it's fascinating. I hope it gets people to realize just by reading the title alone, their responsibility in their own lives, because it's so important.
So true. I'm with you. I think the interesting thing is I used to look at responsibility when I was younger and think, oh man, really? Responsibility? That's tough. it's hard to do. And now I look at it like it's the most freeing thing in the world to take absolute responsibility for everything that has to do with my life. And not point the fingers and not blame and do the best I can to stay away from those things. And like you said earlier, Angela, forgive. You know, forgiveness is huge. And that does it for me. It doesn't necessarily mean forget. It means I can just let go. I can let go of that within me and not hold resentment. I what's the old saying? Having resentment is like taking poison and thinking it's going to hurt the other person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, no, it's, you know, that's not it. So anyway, those are very important keys for me in terms of living and things I talk about in both of my books, actually.
Hey there. It's Angela from Been There, Done That. If you're navigating the wild, unpredictable world of grief, I want to invite you to something special. It's called Messy Mornings, and it's our free weekly newsletter filled with real talk, gentle reminders, and support that actually meets you where you are. Each week, I'll send you stories, reflections, healing prompts straight to your inbox. No fluff, no pressure, just the space to release, feel, and heal. You don't have to do this alone. Head over to donethatpodcast.com and sign up for Messy Mornings. It's totally free, and it's made with you in mind. I've been there, and let's walk through this together.
It really is, and I think that's the point that I have come to with speaking to so many wonderful people on this show, is that people think if they forgive, that that means they forget. People think if they move through their grief, then that means they will forget. That is not how we work as humans. We don't. Yes, we forget in terms of it blocking our path. We have to let it not be our crutch or our excuse or our whatever that is for bad behavior or for not functioning to our highest level, in my opinion, that is. But you don't forget the thing that happened to you. It made you who you are. You can't, that part can't go away. It's the fact that you used it in a dysfunctional way that's the problem. You used it to create a construct that isn't true, or you used it for it, like I said, as a crutch or an excuse, that's the problem. It's not the thing itself. It's what you did with it that becomes the real problem. And we don't give each other permission to do that, especially in a grief situation. When we've lost a person, if there's not closure or if we feel responsible for it, there's all this stuff that gets stuck in the middle there. Grief is bigger than just losing one person or losing multiple people in your life. I personally experienced loss when it came to security as a child. So that became then the thing that I was able to use as my crutch, my excuse to say, no, that has to stay that way because that's what I learned. But when you realize that you can function better, that's what I hear you saying the most, is that when you realize that it doesn't have to look like this, even if it's completely unknown on the other side, treatment or getting out of an abusive relationship or changing career paths, the leap that you're taking is into something you don't know. But if it isn't working where you are, you have a decision to make. And it really is a cool, I loved what you said, that it's freeing. It's so, so freeing to realize you can decide, and it's never too late. It's always great. And you're going to come out the other side with so much more that you've learned. If you were to pick your top two lessons, what would you say would be your top two lessons that you've taken from your life so far?
Yeah, I love that. I do. I love that question, Angela, because, and I think about that and writing books helped me sort of, put that together for myself. I've been doing this stuff a long time, but there are certain things, right, that just stick. And there's probably five that are monumental, like, wow. And then, you know, the next five are like, ooh, yeah, that's cool. You know, but out of all the millions of experiences and millions of things I've heard, right? And those few stick. And the first one is the one I mentioned, which is why my books are titled the way they are, is my mentor or sponsor said, you know, Daryl, when you stop fighting, the fighting stops. And that's huge because we've talked about responsibility, and that puts the responsibility squarely on my shoulders in terms of, you know, figuring that out. And I've been figuring that out ever since. And it's, you know, it's easy. It's a lot easier to fight and point fingers and blame and not clear the wreckage than it is to figure out how to stop the fighting. And one of my favorite words in the English language is allow. How do I allow myself to stop fighting? And that's a huge one. And that plays into my entire life, and that plays into every day. And you know, the big sort of, 800-pound gorilla or whatever you want to call it is, you know, used to be addiction. And then it was, and so that was my big fight. And I'd fight with my parents, and I'd fight with friends, and I'd fight other people, and I just would fight. And I'd fight my emotions, and, you know, and then it comes to, you start getting a little bit more, you know, I'm in AA for a little while, and you know, the 12 steps are sort of integrating into my life. And then the fight becomes things like, you know, I'm not supposed to feel that way anymore. You know, I get angry. Ooh, I'm not supposed to do that. Or I get upset. Oh, I'm not supposed to do that. Or I'm scared. Like, oh, they said I'm not, you know, I don't have to be scared. But, you know, it's that rub, right? It's that friction that I allow in myself, as opposed to just allowing things to come into me and then to leave me. Because they can. They're just emotions. They're not going to kill me. They're just emotions. I can allow them to come, and I can allow them to go. This too shall pass is a big one for me, right? So,
yeah.
So the second one is I was told pretty early on, and I know in 12-step rooms they have, you know, little signs that say first things first, but I was, how it was explained to me is first things first and the rest shall be added on. Basically, to me, that means I have to put it, and it's the things I talked about a little earlier. The practices that I do every day, the breathing, the meditation, the exercise, the gratitude, you know, those things have to be first in my life. And then my life can function properly, because it's kind of like I've never said this before. It's kind of like I've oiled up and greased and, you know, taking care of my car. You know, it's going to run right if I do the right things. And if I don't do those things, I walk into a day and I'm like, oh, you know, what's going on? What's next? You know, and things are flying around. But if I start with a calm demeanor, which is what those things do for me, it sets up my day and it sets up my life. So when you stop fighting, the fighting stops, and first things first and the rest shall be added on are the two most important for me thus far.
I really love the centering piece. Is routine for you now, but I see it more as a vision and values about your process, that you bring it in and say, okay, remember, you're not the only human being on the planet. You are not, you know, you are not the only thing that is hurting right now. Let's figure it out from here. That's what happens to us when we get depressed or when we get in these low spots and we have these horrid seasons in our life, is because we get so wrapped up in what's under the bubble, you know, right here within our little locus of control, that we don't actually act. We just take it all in and say, well, I can't do anything about it. I'm going to use my crutches again. I'm going to fall back on my old ways. I just really love the listening to
again, how practical you have been able to integrate all of this into your life and the changes that you've been able to make. Do you ever look back? It's probably hard to do that. We didn't have technology like we do now. And 1985 was a lot different then than it is now. So how do you look back and how do you reflect on the things that have changed for you over the last almost 40 years?
You know, it's very nostalgic for me. It's very comforting for me. And writing the books was just kind of put it all together, because, you know, I had all this stuff kind of flying around, and I was telling my wife some of the stories, and before she was my wife, and many, many years ago, and she's looking at me, and I was about 20 years sober at the time. She's like, "That's not you, you know, that's not you. I don't see it." And I said, "Well, it was. Remind me to write a book someday." And so she reminded me over the course of the next 18 years, and I finally did. But so it's, you know, I love my life today, but I've also learned that I love my life every step of the way. And you mentioned it earlier, Angela, that we can't have just the great experiences. We got to have the tough ones. And, you know, we have to have, and I look at it like the light sits next to the dark. And it's all part of the balance of living. And I couldn't be where I am now without all the difficult stuff. So looking at life from that perspective, where everything is a stepping stone, you know, everything, no matter what it is, and not judging them as good or bad, just allowing them to be what they are. And, you know, I hear the question a lot, and I see the question a lot. People say, "What's one thing you would change about your life, or what's one thing you regret?" Or, you know, and I say, nothing. There's absolutely nothing. And am I proud of some of the things that happened in my life? No. And, you know, do they, if you look back at them and put them in a little, you know, like here's the little microcosm of some of the stuff that happened, does it suck? Yeah, a lot of it did. It was not good and not fun and whatever. But if I changed one thing, would it change where I'm at now? And so I look back and I say, you know, I wouldn't change a thing, because I'm not proud of it all. Certainly that's true, but it couldn't have happened any other way.
The learning and the growing was worth it, is what I hear you saying. And that you can now take those same experiences and you can help other people that are in similar or could be very different boats, but they just relate to Daryl and want to understand how they can help themselves through that. I love that to a person. I have not had one person say on this show so far, "Yeah, if I could, I would go back and have different parents," or "I would go back and I would stop myself from going down that path." Not one person. And that, to me, is the true definition of resilience, is that you realize that the things that have happened, whether you were holding the shovel or somebody else was holding the shovel, was all for your greater good, was all for the concept that I love how you said without each step, even if I took one tiny piece out of the puzzle, it wouldn't be a whole puzzle anymore. It would be something else. And it's such a cool way to look at it. Again, refreshing, different. I like it. Tell us how we can work with you, how we can find you, how we can find the books, how we can be a groupie and follow you around. How can we do that?
I love that. Well, the books are available on Amazon, and they are, again, When I Stop Fighting and When You Stop Fighting. If you just type those in, they'll show up on Amazon. Okay. My website is Daryl Dittmer, which is DarylDittmer.com. And I do different giveaways and things like that, you know, for audiobooks. And I did audiobooks in my own voice, which I thoroughly enjoyed doing that. I didn't have a clue, but it was fun. It was a fun ride. So those are the best places to find me, really. The books on Amazon and my website. And, you know, I also, one thing I think is really important is writing. I just think, and I never really knew I was going to be an author, and that's okay, because there's a lot of things in my life that I never knew I was going to be or do. But as life unfolds, which is one of the reasons I'm so grateful for how everything has happened, is, you know, it's just sort of unfolded. And so I'm a big advocate of writing, because when I was younger and just getting sober, I used to write, and it was yellow legal pads. And I would just write and write and write, because it helped me sort out my feelings. It helped me see things more clearly, as opposed to just having them run around in my head and my heart. So on my site, I put together journals, and just sort of an FYI, there's one that says rewrite your life story on the cover. You can see them back here, but one that says stop stopping yourself. What does the other one say? Oh, stop fighting, start living. And so it's funny. Look at that.
It's a common theme.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they're helpful, because anytime we're having, you know, emotional or sort of mental distress, sometimes just sitting down and writing helps alleviate a lot of that. And it did for me. And it's just, you know, it doesn't have to be one of these journals. It can be a yellow legal pad. It can be scratching on a napkin. It can be whatever you want. But I want people to know how important writing is for me, and how important I think it is for healing. And so I just wanted you to know that those are also available.
Documenting is a good way to keep that top of mind for you, you know, even if it is on a yellow legal pad, who cares what it looks like? Just write. Just get your pen
or pencil out and just do it. If you have technology, you can do it on a computer or whatever too, but I like paper. It's just me. Maybe it's the fact that you and I are similar in age that helps that, but it doesn't. I think it's just that much more concrete, more physical that you can do that with. I love that. That's great advice. Thank you for giving that. Thank you for being here. Thank you for not deciding that you were not important in this world. Thank you for pushing against that and doing this other thing and going down the treatment path and being here. I'm thankful for your path, because otherwise we wouldn't be having this conversation. You may not have been moved to do the work that you're doing because you didn't think it was that big of a deal if you hadn't gone through the hellfire that you went through. So I appreciate the fact that you have a story, because you're going to help somebody else and millions of other people that hear it just by being you. So thank you for wanting to be a part of the show and for being honest and vulnerable. And for certain, thank you for naming your books what you did, because I'm so fascinated by it.
Thank you. Well, I really appreciate you having me on, Angela. I'm so glad we connected. A little secret is I have a podcast too, so I'm going to have you on mine.
I would love it. That would be super fun.
Especially if we get to talk about getting your head out of your, you know what. So I think that would be an excellent conversation, another excellent conversation to have with you. So thank you so much for being here. And I look forward to having our second conversation.
Sounds great, Angela. Thanks so much. I really appreciate everything.